Hello, hello, and welcome. Welcome, everyone, to this live telephone town hall meeting we have for you this evening. You are live on the line with Congressman Barry Loudermilk. Congressman Barry Loudermilk is our representative right here in Georgia's 11th Congressional District. We are calling out to you this evening to open up the conversation and to answer questions that you may have. The way to get in line with a question is to press 0 on the keypad on your phone. We already have people taking us up on this. So again, get in line early with that question, press 0 on the keypad on your phone. You'll be able to ask that question live over the air of Congressman Barry Loudermilk, or you can have me read it if you would rather not go live. In that case, just let your operator know that, and that is no problem. We are dialing out to thousands of neighbors this evening, so please bear with me as I go through this a few more times. So I'd like to welcome everyone who is just joining the call. You are joining a live telephone town hall meeting we have for you this evening with Congressman Barry Loudermilk. He is our representative right here in Georgia's 11th Congressional District. If you have a question of Congressman Loudermilk, please press 0 on the keypad on your phone. That is 0 on the keypad on your phone. Also, this evening, we are collecting email addresses. If you would like us to keep you up to date via email, please press 7 on the keypad on your phone. That is a really great way for us to keep in touch with you. So again, for regular email updates, please press 7 on the keypad on your phone. We also have a few questions this evening that we value your opinion on, so please stay on the line for those as well. So again, welcome everyone who is just joining. You are joining a live telephone town hall meeting with Congressman Barry Loudermilk. I will be turning this over to him in just a few moments after we finish our dial out a little bit more. We are dialing out to thousands of neighbors, so please stay on the line with us here for just a couple more minutes. This evening, if you'd like to get in line with a question, press 0 on the keypad on your phone. Also, to get updates via email, please press 7. If you want to find us online, you can find us at loudermilk.house.gov. That is L-O-U-D-E-R-M-I-L-K, just like it sounds. We're also on Twitter and Facebook at Rep Loudermilk. So find us there. We'd love to hear from you. So again, welcome everyone. Last time here, I'll go through this as we are dialing out to thousands of our neighbors this evening. You are joining a live telephone town hall meeting with Congressman Barry Loudermilk. We are dialing out to you this evening to open up the conversation and answer questions that you may have. The way to get in line with the question is to press 0 on the keypad on your phone. Again, that is 0 on the keypad on your phone to get in line with that question. If you would rather not go live with that question, that's fine. Still press 0 and let your operator know that, and I can read your question over the air that way. So also this evening, we are collecting email addresses so that we can keep you up to date via email. That is one of the best ways for us to keep in touch with you. So if you would like regular email updates from us, please press 7 on the keypad on your phone. We also have a few questions this evening that we are looking for your opinion on, so stay on the line for those as well. And lastly here, I'll tell you how to touch base with us outside of this call. You can find us online at loudermilk.house.gov and also on Facebook and Twitter at Rep. Loudermilk. So with that, it is now my pleasure to turn this over to the man of the evening himself, Congressman Barry Loudermilk. Why don't you take it away?
Oh, thank you, Allison. And first of all, let me thank everyone who is attending this teletown hall tonight as we are still up here in Washington, D.C. let me start off with addressing something that is on everybody's mind tonight, and that's the horrendous tragedy that happened yesterday down in Parkland, Florida. As we were seeing this hit the news yesterday, it was I can't explain the way that my family and I felt, as well as every member of the staff here, as this horrendous tragedy was unfolding before our eyes here. And you know, having experienced a similar tragic event myself, I can understand what many of those students are going through and what many of their parents are going through. Now, I can't pretend to understand or know what those parents who lost a child yesterday are feeling or going through. I have three children. I have two grandchildren. And fortunately, we've never had to experience something like that with them. But my heart really, really goes out to those parents for the senseless loss of life that we experienced in this nation yesterday. But I do understand what many of those students are going to go through in the coming months with the trauma that they're going to face just from what they experienced, what they saw, what they heard in an area that should be a area of safety and sanctity for those children as they are there trying to learn and become productive members of society and there with their friends. And for them to have to face a horror like this is just something that is hard to conceive for a lot of people. But I do know one thing, is politicizing an event like this only harms those families. And I do not hold to the political adage that we never let a crisis go to waste, because that only harms those that we should be reaching out and helping at this point. My family and I and our staff are praying for those families, for healing, for those that are still in the hospital, and for those families that are grieving. We need to allow them to grieve. But we do have to address the problem that we're facing of the evilness that seems to be prominent in our nation right now, the divisiveness that we have, the hatred that we're experiencing throughout the nation, and the evil that is perpetrated in these schools. And we have to take a serious look at how do we ensure our children are safe. And we don't need to just chase ideas that we think may work. We need to let law enforcement complete their investigation on this. And we need to work with state and local officials and address what can we do to ensure that children are safe at school. How are we going to ensure children are safe when they go to the ballpark to play Little League? How are we going to ensure they're safe at the park? And these are things that we have to address as society. And that is, I can assure you, something that's on the hearts and minds of everyone here in Congress and the president as well. And I'm sure we'll have questions on that today. And it's something, an open dialogue that we should have in the coming days and months. But real quickly on a couple other things that I want to address before we open it up questions, because we do want to know what is on your mind. That's always at the top of our priorities here. But let's move on to a couple of other items. I'd like to share with you some things that we're going to be working on in the next few weeks, as well as some good news that we are seeing in coming around in Georgia and across the nation. And first of all is our Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the positive effect that we're seeing as Americans are beginning to keep more of their money. A quick story, when I was back home a week or so ago, a gentleman that I know that owns a very small business in Cartersville, Georgia, I've known him for a few years, and in fact 2 years ago he came up to me and was talking about how difficult it had become to operate a business. And I understood that, operating a small business of my own for many years. And in fact, he told me a very sad story. Is he's had this family business for decades, and it's so hard to do business. He was preparing to retire and would close the business because it was so difficult to operate a business today. It was so hard to make a profit that his children weren't interested in taking the business over. On the other side, I ran into him just a week and a half ago, and he had a different story. Not only was he now going to continue operating the business, he's going to expand the business. And he said it was because his accountant came to him and he had looked over the new Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and let him know that his small business was going to save $100,000. And he's reinvesting that back into his employees, back into the business, and he's going to expand it. And we're hearing stories like that from all across the state, all across the nation. Just in the 11th congressional district, a family of four on average is going to see nearly $3,000 additional money just because of the tax cuts. And the average household is going to see around $2,000. And this is meaningful to a lot of our families. That's a house payment for some. It's the ability to maybe have a car repaired. It's to take a vacation or buy the new refrigerator they need. Many have told us that they're putting it away for their children's college. So this is the type of thing that we need to stimulate the economy, and as we're seeing, the economy is growing even much further than what we anticipated. And so that's the good news that we want to continue to perpetuate going into this new year, and to empower Americans to be in charge of their own destiny. Other things that we're going to be working on is, because of the increase in the economy and the way that jobs are being created, we now have another crisis we're looking at, and that is we don't have enough people to fulfill the jobs that are coming out. There's about 1.6 jobs available now, and that's only going to increase. The problem is we just don't have the employees to fill those jobs. Ironically, there's about the same number of unemployed in America as there are new jobs coming available. And there's two aspects to why we can't fill those jobs. About 45% of the unemployed do not currently have the skill sets needed to meet these jobs that are coming open and available. And the other aspect is something that I hear continually when I'm in the district meeting with the smallest business owners, is they are having a hard time keeping employees at a lot of the entry-level jobs because of the reforms that we need to make to our welfare programs. And I'm hearing this from across party lines. Democrats and Republicans are asking us, please reform the welfare system to make it to where it's actually a hand up, that it gives people an opportunity to work themselves into their own independence, not just continued dependency on the government. So we're going to be working on that. We're also going to work on workforce development. The president has already proposed expanding Pell Grants to allow for things such as on-the-job training and technical training. We've done a very good job in Georgia with college and career academies, and so we're going to be looking from a federal level what we can do to adopt some of those ideas that the states have done so well and help the states in developing our workforce. A couple other things we're going to be working on in my own office. We're working on a bill that's called Merit, and it's addressing a problem that we have in the federal government right now. We have a lot of federal employees that do an absolute tremendous job. Their heart is there to serve the people. But unfortunately, like in any organization, there are a few bad apples that are able to hide behind an old, antiquated system. And even in cases where people have violated the law, it takes 360 days, on average, 360 days to remove a bad employee from government service, and the taxpayers are paying for their full pay and benefits for that time. That needs to be streamlined. It needs to be fixed, because right now other employees in our federal government are having to pick up the slack for these individuals. So that's something that we're going to be working on. And, of course, we're going to be dealing with the immigration issue. We do have a bill here in the House that possibly be coming up next week. As you've probably heard, every effort in the Senate failed today to address the DACA issue, as well as those things that the majority of Americans feel that are important: securing our southern border, ending chain migration, and stopping a lottery system for visas. And even going to a merit-based immigration system. These are things that every poll that we've seen and people that I've talked to in the district feel that are extremely important, especially from a safety and security aspect for our nation. And so there will be a bill coming to the House in the next few days that I believe is going to get support and move on. So those are just some highlights of things that we're going to be working on in the next coming days and weeks and months, and there's several other things we can talk about, but I want to hear what you have to say. So at this point, let's go ahead and open up the phones for some questions.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. That was Congressman Loudermilk. He is the representative right here in Georgia's 11th Congressional District. We are taking your live questions this evening. We're going to take Katie live here first in just a moment, but I want to tell you how to participate on this call. You can press 0 on the keypad on your phone and to get in line with the question. And also, we are collecting your email addresses this evening. If you want us to keep you up to date via email, please press 7. So now we've got Katie up live first. Katie, go ahead. You're live. Tell us where you're from and what your question is.
Hi there. My name is Katie Jordan. I am from Cobb County, Georgia. I grew up going to Harrison High School. I love where I'm from, and I love living in this district. I would just like to say before my question, sir, I respect your desire to not want to politicize this matter. What I would really like to see is for all of y'all to get together and really, you know, unite, not politicize, not polarize, but unite to tackle this concern we all have about the violence in our school systems. My question is, I'm a nanny, I have younger siblings and a mother who's a teacher. I see all of my loved ones going off to schools every single day. How are you going to stop, you know, the senseless violence? How are you and your colleagues going to address the issues of these terrible automatic rifles, these weapons of mass destruction being used in our school systems?
Well, Katie, thank you so much for that question, because that is a question that's on a lot of people's minds right now. And as I mentioned earlier, I've been on the other side of that type of violence, being shot at many times in the last year by someone carrying what you would consider an assault weapon. This is a very difficult situation, because I remember when I was in school, and when I had my private business, we did a lot of work in schools, and I could see the difference in the schools of today as they were when I was in school. In fact, when I was in school, we didn't have the locking mechanisms or lockdown drills. I mean, we did tornado drills and fire drills. And it's just absolutely amazing to me that the violence that we're experiencing today has worked into the school. What we need to work on, and what I mean by not politicizing is, many are going to take advantage of this situation to push a particular agenda without looking at doing what is going to make a difference. And that's what I want to do. I want to make sure that when the children that you're a nanny for go to school, that they're safe, that your mom, the teacher, is safe in the school. And just by doing one thing, banning a particular type of gun, is not going to fix the problem, because one thing that we've seen through history is it is the perpetrator, it is the person that is carrying this out. In fact, from a standpoint, when you look at this individual who was meant on doing harm, if it wasn't that type of weapon he was using, he would use something else. It was a shotgun. And I'm not trying to minimalize this aspect, but regardless of what law that you pass, if you're just going to go after the gun that was used, violence will continue. I think that the first thing we have to do is look at how can we make the schools safer and more secure. Because look, there was some violence in schools when I was there, but it was mostly fist fights and the bullying and things that you used to attribute to being in schools. But now we're seeing people coming in and doing mass murder in these schools. Whether it's a handgun, whether it's an assault rifle, whether it's a shotgun or any other type of weapon, is how do you keep the weapons from people that we know are bent on doing harm to others, but also how do we secure the schools to ensure that this doesn't continue to happen? And the reality of all this is, from working in the security environment in the past, is schools are very soft targets, because it's pretty well known that it's easy to get into a school, and there's not a large security presence. You know, I look at the airports, and the airports, we've secured the airports. We've secured sports venues. When you go to a Braves game, or you go to, I can remember right after 9/11, my family and I went to an Atlanta Thrashers game. There was tremendous amount of security there. It is difficult to get any type of weapon into these sporting events. How much more important are our schools? What is it that we can do right away that we can work with local and state officials to secure schools? We don't want to create the schools in a prison environment, but there is so much that we can do with technology. There's so much that we can do with increasing our security protocols Because a lot of what I've seen in schools is responding, how do we properly respond when a disaster is happening, instead of how do we actually prevent that disaster from happening. And there's already discussions of this going on here in Washington, D.C., and I can tell you that is definitely going to be a priority of mine, especially as I have two grandchildren that I want to make sure that they're safe when they start their education as well. And I thank you so much for that question.
Thank you so much, Congressman Loudermilk, and thank you so much, Katie. We're going to go to David here in a moment, but first I have one of a couple polling questions for you this evening. You simply vote just on the keypad on your phone. We really value your participation on these. Your opinions are what drive us to do what we do. So the question goes like this. Do you think government workers should be held to the same employment standards as you are at your job? Please press 1 for yes and 2 for no. So again, do you think government workers should be held to the same employment standard as you are at your job? Press 1 for yes and 2 for no. And while you are weighing in on that, Congressman Loudermilk, why don't you go ahead and tell people how we can get in touch with you outside of this call?
Oh, that's a great idea, Allison. First of all, we have a website. Our official website is loudermilk.house.gov, loudermilk.house.gov. We regularly update it. We keep information of what's going on the floor as well as issues that we're working on here. Also, Facebook is Rep Loudermilk, facebook.com/RepLoudermilk, and Twitter and Instagram is at Rep Loudermilk. We encourage people to call our office, not just if, you know, for political issues or you want to express your opinion, which is important, but also many of the people out there have issues with different agencies, such as IRS or the Veterans Administration. There's 94 government agencies that we can actually help you as to be that go-between between you and the agencies. We have a staff of very caring people who do want to help you. And if you want to contact us, you can call our office right there in Woodstock at 770-429-1776. That's 770-429-1776.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Congressman. You can also press 7 right now on the keypad on your phone to sign up for email updates, and we can send you updates that way. And without further ado, we've got David up live next. David, go ahead. You are live. Tell us where you're from and what your question is. Whoops. Looks like David just hung up. We're going to go straight on to Helen. All right, Helen, go ahead. You are live. Tell us where you're from and what your question is.
Congressman, my name is Helen Tritt, and I'm from Kennesaw, Georgia. And I have been concerned about there's so much banter going on about whether we're going to have the security wall or not. And I was just wondering if there's a possibility, is it going to be funded or what kind of security are we going to have from the southern border?
Well, Helen, thank you for that question. It's very important because, look, we needed to secure our borders a long time ago. It's something that's been talked about. The majority of Americans want this. Look, I've spent time down on the border. And it is a dangerous place down there. This isn't the border security issue should be separated from immigration issue. I think it has to be part of the immigration bill we're working on, but it's really a national security and a public security issue of how porous and open our southern border is, as well as the virtual handcuffs that have been placed on our Border Patrol agents over there for the past several decades. There are cartels that operate, human trafficking, drugs, weapons come across the border almost uninhibited in certain areas. And it is a priority here. I would love to tell you right now that I believe we're going to get the wall started. And when we talk about a wall, this is something that I was on the Homeland Security Committee here in Congress, last Congress, and that's something we put a lot of time and effort into, it because a physical barrier doesn't work everywhere. Some of the areas you use technology, some of the areas you just need to put more manpower, and that's what the president has been proposing, is we need to do a combination of things, and that's what the bill that we've worked on here in the House, and we've passed in the House in the past, we're just trying to get it funded, is a virtual fence along the border that is, the key is having more boots on the ground, being able to detect those that are trying to get across the border before they actually come across, getting agents to where they are, as well as putting physical barriers up to slow them down as they try to come across. And so it is something the American people want. It is something for our national security. It's something for protecting the citizens. And I do believe it is something that must be, and the president has already said, is something that must be in the immigration reform bill that, the Senate tried to get several of them through today, but they were blocked by the minority party, by Democrats. We're going to see if we can get the bill through the House, which for most people understand what the House bill does is regarding DACA is just continue the program that Barack Obama started, which is it actually makes it part of law, which says for those that were brought here by their parents, the Dreamers as they're called, they every 3 years they can register to legally be in the country. That'll allow them to work. That'll allow them to go to school. They don't have the full rights of citizens, voting rights and others, but as they can continue every 3 years as long as, you know, they don't have they'll do a background check as long as they're not conducting illegal activities or have a criminal record, they can continue to reapply every 3 years. But it also allows them to apply for citizenship like anybody else would. The irony that we're running into the House right now is that is exactly what President Obama did through executive order, which was unconstitutional, and all the president did was say, we need Congress to fix this. And this bill, besides doing the other things of funding a border wall, as well as ending chain migration, stopping the visa lottery system, doing the things that the majority of Americans want, the Democrats are saying they won't accept it now. And so we'll probably get the bill passed through the House, but I don't know what the Senate is going to do, because it looks like there are some that don't want to fix the problem. They would rather have it to be a campaign issue, and that's the best I can understand. But thank you for the question.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Helen. And now we have, before we do our next polling question, Congressman, I'd like to tell you the results of our last polling question. Again, we just simply asked, do you think the government workers should be held to the same employment standard as you are at your job? And we had 89% of our listening audience said that, yes, government should be held to the same standard. Your thoughts, Congressman?
Well, thank you, Allison. You know, that is consistent with the national polls that we have seen regarding that when it's been asked in the past. And unfortunately, where we are right now, because of the subtle changes that have been made over years in an antiquated civil service code, is they're not held to the same standards. I don't know of a business out there that when a employee is caught stealing from that business, that they get to keep their pay and benefits for an entire year. And in fact, here in the federal government, the Department of Homeland Security paid $380 million in taxpayer dollars paying employees to stay at home and not come to work because of disciplinary reasons they lost their security clearance and couldn't work, but it takes so long to actually get them off the payroll. And so that's pretty consistent, and as I said, we're working to try to fix that problem.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Congressman. We have David up live next. David, go ahead. You are live.
Oh, fantastic. I thought I got hung up on. My name is Dave Geffings. I'm a student and teacher at Kennesaw State University, and I do want to thank you for taking the time to do this, but I really would have liked to have had you do this in person. I've been waiting for you to hold a town hall for quite some time now, months actually. And I know you don't want to politicize the issue in, with the latest school shooting, but how about politicizing the last 18 shootings that have taken place already this year? I understand it's not just guns, it's not just mental health, but when you're dismissive of the gun issue, you're doing a disservice. And I want you to interact with your constituents, Congressman. I want to be able to get through to you, and I find it very difficult to do so.
Well, thank you, David, for that that question. But we're talking right now, and I hope you've taken advantage of calling our office. And look, we've, and I'm not just speaking by hyperbole. I'm speaking from somebody who has been in that very situation, actually more than once, of having actually somebody shooting at me and absolutely no way of defending myself. And one thing I can tell you is there is no gun law that you could pass that will stop someone who is intent on killing someone from getting a gun and actually perpetrating it. Whenever we enact, and there are some things that I think that we can do to strengthen dealing with mental health, looking at access to by certain individuals. I think we need to do more with law enforcement of profiling who may look. There's evidence that this individual had something out on social media that indicated that at least students in the school knew that he was a potential threat. So it isn't just a single thing that we go after. And, you know, I want to make sure that what we do is effective. And I do not believe from personal experience that, and this is potentially what will happen, is somebody will pass some type of gun control law and then walk away from the situation. And I can promise you that is not going to solve the situation. If you go and you look at the number of deaths that have happened, even through terrorism, over the world and in the nation, more have been killed by trucks, by knives, by bludgeoning instruments, by planes than there have just with firearms. And so we have to focus on the perpetrator, not just try to go after the implement that they're using. And I know that there are many that are going to disagree with me on that. But I can tell you the most vulnerable I've ever felt is when I was being pinned down by someone with a semi-automatic weapon, firing over 20 shots at me, and I had no way of defending myself. And I ensured that I would never get in that position again, and I never wanted my children to be in that position where there wasn't somebody there who could fight back. And as far as an in-person town hall, we've got our schedule out now, so we know what our legislative schedule is for this year. We're going to be looking at doing that. But I can promise you, we always make ourselves accessible. I'm in the district quite often. We have meetings all across. The district, I've done in a lot of different businesses and organizations, and I always encourage you to please call, because if I tell people if you don't feel that we're being accessible, please let me know, because I can promise you, as of today, there were many people called our office, and many people have emailed, and many people get in touch with us. But thank you, David, for that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, David, and thank you so much, Congressman. Now we have our second polling question of the evening. Again, just simply voting on the keypad on your phone. Thank you so much to everyone who weighed in on the first one. This polling question goes like this. It is important to you for Congress to focus on securing our borders as part of immigration reform. Press 1 for yes and 2 for no. So again, is it important for you, for Congress, to focus on securing our borders as a part of immigration reform? And while you weigh in on that, I want to remind you, press 7 on the keypad on your phone to sign up for email updates. That's one of the best ways we can keep in touch with you. Press 7 on the keypad on your phone. We had a lot of people sign up, but our queue is empty now, and we are ready for those questions. We're ready for you to press 0, and we're ready for those emails. And now we have Jim up live next. Jim, go ahead, you're live. Tell us where you're from and what your question is.
My name is Jim Barner, and I'm from Ackworth. And I'd like to thank the congressman and his family for serving the district over the past 2 years. And I've had the privilege of attending many meetings and forums with the congressman, and he's always been very forthright and very generous with his time. But my question is, in 2017, healthcare was at the top of the agenda for the president and the Congress. and now it's just simply has fallen off the radar with healthcare costs rising and also the monthly premiums rising and deductibles rising to the extent that some families can't even use their health care. I'm in a little more fortunate situation, but there's so many out there that can't. What happened to health care, and what are you doing about it?
Well, thanks, Jim, because that is a question many of us are actually trying to come up with a solution with. Just quite frankly, the problem we're running into, well, first of all, we're already going to see another 15% increase in the next couple of months on the Obamacare plans. And, you know, as much as our tax cuts have done good, there are some businesses that have come to me and said, look, we thank you so much for the tax cuts. They're helping. But a good portion of the money we're going to save is going to go right back in to healthcare premiums. The reality of why they're going so high is because of the over-intervention by the federal government trying to force on businesses, on individuals, something that in many cases they can't afford. And if you look at the healthcare premiums that are out there now, they are much more costly than what was available before the Affordable Care Act, and the deductibles are so high they're almost unusable. And we addressed that in the House last year. Look, it is, and I actually was meeting with Newt Gingrich yesterday. He's doing a lot in the healthcare industry, and Newt Gingrich said, look, you tried last year to do an overall sweeping reform, but you just showed you can't do it. You can't get it through the Senate. And so what we're going to have to do is start working this year instead of a single just overall bill trying to reform the whole system, which is almost impossible to do at this point anyhow, because it's a combination of the cost of health care as well as the cost of health insurance. And so we're working to first address the rising premium costs. Now, the president did institute an executive order. He made an executive order earlier this year that is going to open the door to reinstatement of the group plans that we used to have, where small businesses could join in with their chamber or their realtor association or trade association to actually buy a group plan that was much more affordable. Unfortunately, through the Affordable Care Act, those went away. And so he basically signed executive order that would allow for those who were in that uninsured category that we can actually create those. We're looking at doing some things such as the state of Maine did with risk pools to where we can take those with pre-existing conditions and insurance companies, as well as the state governments and the federal government, actually participate in a risk pool that those insurance premiums are written out of that will actually help bring down the cost of insurance. But the one thing that we have to do is get it out from the federal pocket. Look, the federal government basically told every insurer out there, health insurer, you can only offer three types of plans, silver, gold, and a bronze. There's no innovation. I had an employee in my small business who was in his early 20s, and at the time he had no intention of getting married. He was single. He was trying to save money, and he was forced to buy a plan that had maternity coverage, and he was not allowed to buy another plan. So now that we've repealed the individual mandate, we need to go in and we need to remove the government imposed mandates across the board to allow insurance companies to come up with plans that actually meet the needs of the people, while we still ensure that those that need insurance but can't afford it are able to get insurance. So it is something that you haven't heard a whole lot about this year, because we're working on a series of plans and solutions that we believe that I know we can get out of the House, but also that we believe can actually pass the Senate and go into effect as soon as possible. So it is something we haven't forgotten about. It is extremely important in this nation, and we're working on some solutions. I think you'll be hearing more about that in the next few weeks. But thank you so much for the question.
Yes, thank you so much, Jim. Now, Congressman, I'm going to let you know the results of the last poll that we did. Again, the poll was, is it important to you for Congress to focus on securing our borders as a part of our immigration reform? And on this one, we had 64% of our listening audience said yes, that is important, and the remaining 36% said no. Your thoughts?
Well, that's a little low from what we've seen from polling throughout Georgia as well as across the nation. Most of the securing the borders polls in around the upper 70s and low 80% of American people, and these are bipartisan polls. So I appreciate that. The majority of the people in the district still agree that that must be a high priority. Because, like I said, this is a national security issue more so than an immigration issue.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We're going to go right back to question and answers. We've got James up live next. James, go ahead. You're live. Tell us where you're from and what your question is.
Yes, I'm from Acworth, Georgia, and my question has to do with the budgets, and actually a twofold question. One is concerning the long-term budget deficits and where we're going with that. I'm concerned that, you know, how are our grandchildren going to get us out of this? When are we ever going to have a... And then, ironically, I guess, in some ways, I'm also concerned about what they're talking about with cuts to, as a senior citizen, cuts to Medicare.
Oh, yeah, thank you for the question. I'll address the budget issue to start with. This is something that I've, when I campaigned for Congress, was a high priority, is still a high priority. One of the, just so people can understand how large our federal debt is, it's over $20 trillion. Now, most Americans don't know what $20 trillion really are. I don't, and I've talked to bankers who don't understand how much money that really is. So real quickly, let me put it in perspective. If you know what today's date is, then you know historically when Jesus was born, because that's what we base our modern calendar on. So that's something everyone can relate to. So if you were to go back to the moment that Jesus was born, well over 2,000 years ago, and you deposited $17,000 in the bank, and 60 seconds later you deposited another $17,000, and 60 seconds later you repeated that, and you continued to put away $17,000 every minute since Jesus was born to today, you still would not have $20 trillion. You would not be able to pay off the debt. That's $17,000 every minute since we've been keeping the modern calendar. That's how massive our debt is. It has grown so massive that it is. We cannot tax enough to pay off the debt. We cannot. If we taxed every business and every individual based on what our gross domestic product was over the past 8 years, there would not be enough money to pay off this debt. So you cannot tax your way out of it unless you improve the economy. And that's one of the key issues that we did with the tax cuts bill, is because Ronald Reagan proved it. If you allow Americans to keep more of their money in their back pocket, if you allow businesses to grow, to create jobs, more people are employed, there's more money circulating in the economy, and tax revenues for the government will grow without raising individual taxes. It's almost backwards thinking for some people. You cut taxes, you get more tax revenue. And that's what we're seeing happen right now. About 3 years ago, we were told that the new normal for our gross domestic product, you know, which is the measurement of how strong our economy is doing, is going to be no more than 1% to 2% from now on. The Federal Reserve in Atlanta just predicted last week that this year our gross domestic product will hit over 4%. That's beyond everything that we estimated. We're expecting to actually see that increased revenue coming in. Now, we had to make an investment in the American people to get to that. So the tax cuts bill is really what is driving a lot of the deficit right now, because we initially had to cut the amount of revenue coming by cutting taxes. You're initially going to hit a revenue hit. So it's going to reduce the amount of money coming in, which is going to increase the deficit. The other aspect of that is our military. As a veteran, I can tell you, with a son who served in the Army Airborne, our military is in deplorable condition. In fact, in the last year, we've lost more of our servicemen and women to training accidents than were actually killed in combat. And that's a sad situation. When literally we have planes falling out of the air, we have to, with threats like North Korea, with Iran, with Russia, we actually have to do something to strengthen our military, provide them with the equipment that they need to do their job effectively. So we had to make that investment. The problem we've run into is right now with the way things are structured is if you increase your defense spending, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle insist that we increase domestic spending as well. To me, that isn't just a reason to do it. It makes no sense because you have to do something that you should have to do something else, especially when our deficits are so high. So to answer that, we're going – the president has already come out with his budget. The House is going to be working on our budget coming out. Now, you may have heard that we've CR that we passed included a two-year budget. Basically, those are target numbers. We don't have to appropriate to that. We're still going to do our budgets. In fact, the president's budget that came out had $1.7 trillion in cuts for deficit spending. Now, it's going to take us a while to get there, but if we can find fiscal responsibility, and there's a growing number of people here in Congress that want to do it, if we can pass a balanced budget amendment, if we continue to see the economy grow the way that it's projected to grow right now, and we are fiscally responsible, we can put us on a path to reduce the deficits and eliminate that debt. And it's not going to happen. I mean, it's going to take time, but you can, in a period of 10 to 20 years, get a handle on this debt if we continue to do things the right way and even accelerate it and do it better, quicker with a balanced budget amendment. There is no way to eliminate the debt, and this is getting to the Social Security question. If we continue on the same trajectory that we're on right now with Social Security, I think your question was on Medicare, our current welfare, the way that we're handling, there's going to have to be reforms. But whatever reforms we do on Social Security and Medicare should not affect those who are on those programs now. I mean, look, on Social Security, I'm likely not to see any of the money that I'm invested because by the time I retire, it's going to be upside down. So what we need to do is have both sides come together and come up with innovative ideas of how we can transition for future generations to assure that these programs are available for them other ways of doing things are there, but without affecting those who are dependent on it today.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Congressman, and thank you so much, James. We're going to go to William live here in a moment, but for our listening audience, I want to give a last call, as it were, to press 7 to sign up to receive those email updates. So again, press 7 on the keypad on your phone to sign up for email updates. And with that, we will go to William live next. William, go ahead. You are live. Tell us where you're from and what your question is.
Hello, Congressman. I'm from Canton, Georgia, and I wanted to ask you about your merit bill that you had talked about earlier. I was wondering how you would ensure that there was no ability for political retribution in our government offices, such that, you know, if a Democrat gets elected and has a Democrat secretary, that secretary can't say, all right, let's fire all the Republicans, and then, you know, turn around the next 4 years and do the same thing the other way.
Right.
And the other question that I had was, with the VA, I had a tenant who retired from the military, and then they determined that they had overpaid her, and so they in her retirement package, they just took out the overpayment they had determined as a lump sum and left her with no money coming in from her retirement for 3 or 4 months straight. And those are the two questions that I had.
Okay, and thanks, William. Let me take these in reverse order here, because that's very concerning what you just told me about what happened to your tenant. And no matter how you break that down, that is wrong. To the way to treat a veteran, even if a mistake was made, the government made that mistake. And to go back and take that money immediately from her is wrong. And that's why what we're seeing right now, and this has been growing over the past 10 years, there is a historic number of people who do not trust their government. And part of the reason is, and the major reason is because of things such as this. There is no customer service in a lot of the agencies out there, or people feel that that's true, and that's why our office spends so much time and effort and money on actually trying to help citizens get so frustrated dealing with this huge and unfriendly and uncaring government that we have. And a lot of it is because of career bureaucrats that have never even worked in the areas that they're regulating, or they're not veterans. They don't really understand what's going on with people's lives. And so my office has actually been working on legislation that we're going to be introducing here very soon in the next couple of weeks that actually sets customer service standards. So when people call the government and they're dealing with the government, they're actually going to be treated properly, and that instead of just pushing them off, that they'll actually get service. And so we're already seeing changes in the VA, and I'll tie that back into merit. Is the merit bill that we have is modeled after what was done in the VA recently. We're already starting to see some change in the VA because it allowed the Veterans Administration to remove employees who have shown a history of not serving the people, or bad conduct, or not doing their job. We've ensured that we're not replacing the existing laws that are there. We also have protection for whistleblowers, and we're writing it to where it's clear that anyone who is removed can only be removed for performance, documented performance issues. And if you look at and if someone is removed, let's say for a political reason, they can appeal to the Merit Systems Protection Board, which is a bipartisan board that actually hears the appeals. And so with that protection in place, that's what's going to protect against these political firings just because there's a new administration. And it's a valid concern, and we've tried to take every effort to avoid that from happening.
Excellent. Thank you so much, and thank you, William. Our next question comes from Vanessa, but she asked that I read her question over the air. It goes like this: how is the government going to protect us from Russia during elections? Your thoughts, Congressman?
Well, let me tell you, Russia's been meddling in elections for decades. If you go back and you look at the first known instance that we have of the Russians meddling in elections, actually goes back to the Carter campaign. I believe it was Mondale and Carter who were running in a primary, if I get my history right. I was a young person back then. But we found out recently that Jimmy Carter actually invited the Russians to, or asked the Russians to engage in the campaign. Or actually it was Kennedy who originally reached out to him. Then John F. Kennedy, but his brother Ted Kennedy. Then as Reagan was challenging Carter for the presidency, Carter reached out to the Russians and asked if they would get involved because, you know, his reasoning was that Reagan would be a warmonger and drive us closer to a nuclear war. And so they invited the Russians to get involved. So part of the problem is us politicizing, trying to get foreign governments involved in our elections. And look, we've done it before. During the Obama administration, that administration tried to sway the Israeli elections. And so we need to respect other nations as well as we expect nations to respect us. We need to ensure that we have integrity of our ballots. We need to ensure that when people go to the polls, that their votes are recorded accurately. And these are things that the states have to do. We need to ensure that through improving our cybersecurity, that voting lists and rolls are not subjected to disclosure. There's some things that are a little more difficult. Russia's investing in Facebook ads and other things like that. Things we just need to be aware of is that I tell people all the time, if just because you read it on Facebook, it's probably not true. There's going to be an element of truth to it, but you need to be very skeptical of just everything that you read on Facebook. The thing that concerns me the most is what we're uncovering right now. As the investigation into Russian meddling is unfolding, it appears that there has been another invitation for the Russians to meddle in our elections, and we're uncovering more and more evidence of that. As you know, that we just released a memo from the House that when I read it, I was in the Air Force during the Cold War. I worked intelligence, and when I read that memo and I saw what had happened, I could not believe that was happening in the United States of America, that we would actually reach out to a foreign entity to basically use false documents to spy on American citizens. Those are things that happen in Russia. They don't happen in the United States. So we need to make sure that we remove the corruption that does exist in a lot of our agencies, especially those in the Department of Justice and the FBI. So regardless of how the outcome of election is, that Americans can feel that the election was done properly and that they're not subjected to unconstitutional searches and seizures and just having the American government spying on people for political reasons.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And we have Arlene up live next. Arlene, go ahead. You're live. Please tell us where you're from and what your question is.
I'm in Stone Mountain, Georgia. I don't know how I got picked on your thing, but I was glad to have the opportunity to ask him about the Social Security, although another gentleman already asked about it, too, after I did. But I get these letters every day from different groups with the government. I don't know if they're with the government or not, but all of them are wanting donations to help go before the House and Senate to take, like, my questions and other people's questions that they are sending and asking for.
Arlene?
Yes.
Arlene, did you have a question about Social Security, dear?
Yes.
Okay.
I want to know if the House and the Senate, if they are taking money from Social Security for their to use for their campaign promises and campaign to help them get it reelected.
No, ma'am, not at all. In fact, that's illegal and it's impossible to do. Without getting too technical, Social Security is funded by what's called a mandatory budget, which means by law, and if you remember back years ago, Al Gore talked about a lockbox, putting Social Security in a lockbox. It's in a lockbox. What we call the mandatory budget means that when we start budgeting for spending, like what we just did, funding the military, that's in a separate budget called the discretionary budget. The only time that Social Security has been affected was during the Affordable Care Act. There was looks at the previous administration of using Social Security to actually supplement some of the extraordinary cost of the Affordable Care Act. But you do not see that being used, and it can't be used by politicians today to fund other things through Social Security. Mm-hmm. And so I would be very cautious of sending money to any organization that is claiming that we're doing that, because right now, and one of the problems we're facing is a lot of our debt and deficit is being driven by not so just Social Security, but a lot of things in the mandatory budget. But the short answer to your question, which was a very good question, and I'm sorry that you're getting a lot of those letters and requests, is that there is not a way that we can take that Social Security money and use it for other political purposes.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much, Arlene. And Congressman, with that, we have just about reached the end of our allotted time. So I'd like to turn this back to you for some closing remarks.
Well, Alton, thank you so much. You were a gracious host today, and I want to thank everyone who participated. And I know there it was impossible to get to every question you had out there, but we do want to hear from you. Whether you agree with me or disagree, that's okay. But I would ask this, when you call our offices, and I encourage people to call, and we understand that there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of issues that are very important to folks. Our people here generally do care about what your thoughts and your ideas are, and they work very hard to make sure that because I'm very busy during the day with a lot of the work that we have here, I am given a list every day of the callers we have, the major issues, and if somebody's having a real issue that we need to address, we're gonna work on addressing that. And one thing I would like to see more of is more civil discourse. And I think that's one of the things that is missing in America today, is we have grown an intolerance for anybody who has a different opinion than what we have. And I can guarantee you call our office, even if you disagree, you're going to be treated with respect and dignity because your opinion matters. And I think that if we can focus on doing anything in America is to once again return to the great American idea of agreeing to disagree on some things, and not with the hatred and the anger that we so often see, especially on social media. I think that we would get a whole lot more done if we can talk and we can discuss, we can compromise, and we can find those things that we agree on, because most of us here in Washington and most Americans have the same end in mind. We all want a nation that is free, that's safe, and full of opportunity. But quite often we start arguing on the road to get there before we even decide how we're going to go. And so if we didn't get to your question today, please call our office, give us an email, and we would be glad to follow up with you and make sure that you get your question answered.
All right, excellent. Thank you all so much again, and have a great rest of your evening.